tortured dissidents and imprisoned them. They remember how there was a huge rate of poverty, how there was a huge gap of income. They remember how the country was basically just obeying and bowing down to the US policies. And they also remember, for example, that during the first Pahlavi, there was this attempt to forcefully remove women's hijab on the streets, and because the Pahlavi wanted to modernize Iran. And by modernizing Iran, it means only to just copy the dressing style of Europe.
I guess it's not surprising, is it, that the Zionist regime welcome Pahlavi to the place there? I mean, but you know, in geopolitical terms, do you think it could damage them? And indeed, do you think it could even damage him, for that matter?
Well, I think we're moving into a period now where Israel is becoming even more unpopular than it has already been for many, many years. Even its closest supporters are raising questions about it, including in the US. The Pahlavi and the other oppositionists in Iran, they don't have any support really in Iran itself, and so that is the question: Will Pahlavi damage himself by associating himself with Zionists? Probably yes. And will the Zionists damage themselves by associating themselves with the opposition in Iran? Well, not so clearly, but of course they are geopolitically backing the opposition in Iran. They, of course, have direct involvement in terrorist attacks. They've killed nearly 10 nuclear scientists, murdered them in their cars, sometimes in Tehran. I've actually, when I was in Tehran just the other week, I saw the cars of I think 8 or 9 of the scientists who were assassinated by Mossad. So that's direct involvement. They're involved with the Kurds in Kurdistan, and they're involved in fostering terrorist attacks in Iran as well. So of course they have to support the opposition in Iran, but everybody knows, don't they, that the opposition that there is in Iran is sponsored by, yes, the Israelis, and also by the CIA.
Well, I also asked Sitara, I mean, what it actually says about the mindset of Pahlavi's wife, that she posted an image on social media of an occupation forces operative with the slogan, "Women, Life, Freedom."
Everyone in Iran, and obviously a lot of people outside Iran, even non-Iranians, found that very ironic, and they made comments on it. I also retweeted that and made comments because I found it very ludicrous that for the Pahlavi family, an IDF soldier could represent freedom for women, because we all know how the IDF has been oppressing Palestinians, both men and women and children, how the IDF has or is continues to kill and massacre Palestinians and to jail them and to and they have no mercy even to children. So it is ridiculous, and but it is very much reflective of the Pahlavi mentality.
David, did just say a word or two, will you, about those British settlers who spoke to Pahlavi and said that their families knew each other. I mean, just say a bit about that. It's quite.
Well, it was quite an extraordinary
Yes,
moment.
it
I mean,
was.
this is a group of British settlers. The guy who's a rabbi, the father, used to be a rabbi in a synagogue in London, and he took the whole family out there into an illegal settlement, stolen Palestinian land, and then two of his daughters and his wife were eliminated by the resistance. And you see that little meeting that they have, and the videos are there on social media. And one of them says, "Well, actually, I think we know your relatives." And he says, "No, I don't think you do." And then they have this discussion where it becomes apparent that actually his relatives knew Pahlavi's relatives. And it really does illustrate the closeness of these kind of elites who are hostile to power coming from developing countries and challenging Western power. They're really very close to each other, such that their families even know each other. Who'd have thought that some kind of, if you like, random settler family in occupied Palestine would actually have potential family connections to the potential dictator of Iran?
Yes, absolutely. Curious state of affairs, I must say. But anyway, I also asked Sitara how she thinks the trip to occupied Palestine was received in Palestine and in Iran.
Well, I mean, the majority of the people here hate the Pahlavi family, and they have not forgotten the history of the oppression by this regime, the last dictator in Iran. But it received even more criticism because it happened at a time when inside the occupied territories, the Israeli regime was having problems with its own settlers. Like, the settlers were protesting inside the occupied lands against the Israeli regime. And it was at a time, or right after a time, when there were disputes and unrest inside the occupied territories and against the Israeli regime. So it was like double ironic. And even among Iranian expats that want a change inside Iran, you could see that they were criticizing him because, first, he claimed that he represents the Iranian nation, but he does not. Nobody in Iran, not Iranians outside Iran, believe that Pahlavi represents them in any way. But it's also very ironic because he claimed that he's representing in Iran in meeting the Israeli regime officials. And he also forgot that the same Netanyahu that he's praising had previously in a statement in his account of the Bible story was humiliating Iranians and was accusing Iranians of being hostile to the Jewish people, which is not true. I come from a city where we have active synagogues, we have active churches, and obviously active mosques, because it's like the city of Isfahan is known to be the home to Armenian Christians and Iranian Jewish people, and Jewish people have representatives in the Iranian parliament.
Well, let's just pause the discussion there for a moment, as we've got another report now about Pahlavi's frantic efforts to drum up support.
The temporary Zionist entity appears more and more doomed with each passing week. It is hard to tell which is the more desperate: the pretender to the non-existent throne of Iran, or the faltering occupation of Palestine. Pahlavi is desperate to strut the world stage, pressing his claim to the throne, and to try and gain support anywhere he can, even from the irreducibly racist settler colony. At the same time, his CIA sponsors try and present a broad opposition movement to the Islamic Republic of Iran. On January the 1st, they published a coordinated message on social media. Reza Pahlavi was joined by CIA stooge Mashi Alinejad and several others, including grassroots activists and president and spokesman of the Association of Victims' Families of Flight PS752, Hamid Eshmaelian. They met collectively in late March in Toronto, but since then their collective has appeared to be shaky, with at least one member leaving. It seems Pahlavi didn't tell the rest of his comrades that he was planning to collude with the temporary Zionist entity. After Palestine, Pahlavi then jetted off to Italy to be greeted with praise by far-right monarchist supporters as he lobbied the far-right Italian government to further punish the people of Iran via sanctions. Meanwhile, in the temporary Zionist entity, hitherto allies seem to be moving away at an alarming speed. The Chinese brokered deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the restoration of diplomatic relations with Syria and Iran by Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, the talks between Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey, the possible end of the war in Yemen, even the US is cautious of its traditional ally, are all bad news for the Zionist entity. Pahlavi and the Zionist entity envisage the end of the Islamic Republic, which they hasten to bring about. But the reality is that the Republic is on the multipolar side of history, and the collapse of the unipolar US power will only mean that the liberation of Palestine is hastened from the river to the sea.
Well, I asked Sitara how she thinks the emerging multipolarity is influencing how the world sees Iran and Palestine.
That's true. I think with the attempts to de-dollarize transactions across the world, with attempts to shift from relying on the U.S., from being more self-reliant and being more cooperative with China and Russia as the other superpowers. We are seeing more examples of how nations can now be brave enough, I would say, to stand to the U.S. Balling policies and to figure out a way that works better for their own nation and for the people of the world. This also includes more pressure on the Israeli regime, because as more people and as more nations want their governments, want their states to stand against the U.S., they also want more gestures of rejecting the Israeli apartheid regime and the occupation in Palestine.
David, we just heard in the package there that the CIA's attempt to cobble together a broad opposition movement to the Islamic Republic is faltering. I mean, would you say that Palestine was influential in the fracturing of that coalition?
It would seem so. I mean, it seems that him neglecting to tell his erstwhile colleagues that he was going to Palestine has caused the fracturing to happen, because, of course, to associate for people in Iran, like the guy from the campaign for the people who were shot down in that Ukrainian aircraft, I mean, that's kind of a red line issue, and that you know, so that actually aligning with the Zionist entity is difficult for those in the Iranian opposition, because they're so widely hated in Iran. But let me just say about this Ukrainian airline, I mean, it's a really interesting case. This is people might not remember, it's a Ukrainian passenger airline which was shot down accidentally by the IRGC. Now, this guy is campaigning for the people who were killed in Iran and outside Iran. But, of course, what's just happened in Iran is that the people who were responsible, the military people who were responsible, have just been found guilty in court and sentenced to prison sentences. And it's an extraordinary contrast with countries like the UK or the US, where people who are in power and the police or the military really, rarely, if ever, go to jail. And that's a really real contrast. It shows the difference in Iranian politics and the way in which Palestine might, therefore, have a key role in fracturing a coalition like this, much to the disappointment of the CIA.
Not only do they not go to jail, but people that expose abuses, war crimes,
themselves,
I'm thinking Julian Assange, that's for example, right, ends up in prison as a political prisoner being tortured, actually in solitary confinement in Belmarsh while waiting extradition to the US. Well, anyway, I asked Sitara for her thoughts on the divisions amongst this purported unified coalition being presented by the CIA.
Well, these people and these so-called opposition figures had a lot of disagreements from the beginning. And those of us inside Iran who could see through the propaganda could see the fall and the collapse of this so-called coalition coming very soon. They all agreed that they didn't want the Islamic Republic, but what they did not agree on was what to replace the Islamic Republic with and how to fight in their imagination, the Islamic Republic. They also were so detached from the realities on the ground in Iran that they thought they are reflecting the will, power of or what the Iranians actually want, which was not true. I mean, Iranians inside Iran, they, like any other nation, like any other democratic nation, they might have disagreements and dissatisfactions with parts of the functions of the government, and they know how to voice that. They know how to pursue changes. And we have been doing that through our parliament and different government bodies and electing different people into power. But these people just wanted to pursue their own agenda.
David, just remind us, really, about Mahsa Ahmadinejad and her involvement in directing protests in Iran.
Well, she was one of the leaders of the Women Life Freedom protests. I mean, she lives in New York,
yes,
but she was one of the leaders from there. And, of course, her day job is as a paid propagandist by the American government. She works for Voice of America, has received from the American government almost $500,000 in the last eight or 9 years for her work effectively lying about Iran. Here she is in this coalition as a potential leader of a new government in Iran. Well, you know, everybody knows that this is simply a CIA operative working on behalf of the the US government and its interests, and not someone who has any role in thinking about the interests of the people of Iran. And she was one of the ones who tried to pretend that this was all about the hijab and women's rights. But of course, her real demands are increased sanctions, which will only help, which will only harm the people of Iran, as opposed to improving women's rights. So that this is an indication, really, of the level of the people who are involved in the opposition.
Oh, you say everybody knows, but of course some people are indeed duped, aren't they, by the propaganda and think this woman is some sort of heroine. I mean, you know, we see this on social media, don't we?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, it's the weaponization of feminism by US imperial power. I mean, you know, we ought to be able to understand that now. It's as people say, you ought to be able to walk and chew gum. Yeah,
indeed.
You know, feminism and women's rights are not the same as US imperial power.
No, absolutely. And this is coming to light more and more, and hopefully people are kind of waking up. But I think people are indeed more and more waking up. Well, anyway, I asked Sitara if she thinks the issue of Palestine is likely to win Pahlavi any friends in the Iranian opposition or elsewhere.
I think so. As I said, he is so detached from the realities on the ground. He hasn't been inside Iran. He has not been working. I mean, he's been sitting there and receiving money from the U.S. government, probably from Iran's and Iranians' frozen assets. He doesn't make any attempt to understand what the Iranians inside Iran actually want. So I would say, yes, I think this came from a very wishful thinking, from a very, it was coming from a very big lack of understanding of what the Iranians actually want. But if he actually even looked back at the history of Iranian support for Palestine, for the Palestinian cause, even during his father's ruling over Iran, he would understand how the Iranian nation has always been supportive of Palestine.
Well, finally, David, I mean, the abundant signs of emerging multipolarity are all around us, aren't they? I mean, does that influence, do you think, how we should interpret Pahlavi's visit?
I think it does. I think that if this had happened 3 months ago or 4 months ago, before multipolarity really gathered pace with the brokering by the Chinese of the Saudi-Iran deal, then we would see it differently. But because we've now seen all of this, and the most recent, of course, is the Saudis cozying up to Hezbollah, which is a truly, truly extraordinary thing. Who would have thought, even a month ago, that would be on the cards?
Indeed.
And these things are coming thick and fast. And so the changes are all really quite self-evident in a way, but it's not clear how those changes will have an impact. We do know in relation to the Zionist entity, for example, as we've shown in this program just the other week, that the U.S. is becoming increasingly skeptical of the Zionist entity, and have the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, the CIA psychic, has been funding some of the demonstrations inside Israel, which is extraordinary. So the way in which Pahlavi and the Zionists are putting themselves on the wrong side of multipolarity is an indication really of their weakness, because as the power leaches away from the US, they won't have the big bad boy in the corner to be their friend anymore.
Indeed. Well, we're certainly living in interesting times, aren't we? I'm afraid that's it for today's show. I want to thank our guests, Sitara Siddiqui, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Jannah wasiyul mustafa haqqan imam an-nas wal
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We were basing our discussions on the first sermon of Nahjul Balagha, where Imam Ali alayhi salam in some of the phrases discusses about the philosophy behind the coming of the prophets, or the basically the duties and responsibilities that they had. And in one of those phrases, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَيُثِيرُ لَهُمْ دَفَائِنُ الْعُقُولِ, that one of the duties of the messengers is to excavate, to bring forth the hidden or the buried intellects, the buried potentials of the people in terms of their thinking and in terms of their intellection. And this is something that is something repetitive throughout history, that the enemies of the truth have always been using. And we discussed about that, about this in depth in the previous session. So basically, the prophets came to save this beautiful and very precious jewel called the jewel of intellect that is within the hearts and the minds of the people, and save them from destruction and annihilation.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, one of the discussions that we are very prone to have in the sessions of Nahjul Balagha is the issue of using the intellect. Because as you know, Islam, especially the Shia faith, and the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam give a lot of importance to intellectual reasoning and thinking. And this is one of the keynote factors of the Shiite theology and the Shiite way of thinking, where the intellect is given that importance and that place. Of course, in the Shiite theology and in the Shiite epistemology, and in also the different discussions that are to do with Shiaism, there are limits to the intellect. It doesn't mean that the intellect is completely free and can enter all the diverse different fields of human existence. That is an epistemological discussion, but what we generally want to say, it is to a certain degree limited, but it is a very firm and strong tool of knowledge that can be used in different fields. Now, what we now realize is that this intellect and the intellectual processes that are very necessary for human existence, they are sometimes buried by the enemies, and this jewel needs to be excavated. And normally these are, the reason why they are buried is because of propagating some imaginary and false ideas and thoughts. And we discussed about those different thoughts previously. And if I just give you another example, is in the issue of colonialism, which we just recently faced, or the whole history of humanity faced, recently, this idea of colonialism and nations and all that. And even today we see remnants of that colonialism in the form of certain countries still taking the land of other countries. I mean, a very clear example is the example of Israel. And there are other examples also in the world that are still manifestations of the idea of colonialism. For example, till today we have got some areas that are being controlled by the French, by the English, and of course are very small areas, but still they are. We have still remnants of colonialism, unfortunately. And normally what happens is that for the colonial powers to continue to rule, of course, previously what they would do is that they would not allow intellectual growth in those areas in a very strong manner until they were ready to deal with certain areas of intellectual growth that even limited, and then they knew how to take forward their roles in a very, very advanced manner in such a way that they still were controlling the resources indirectly. And unfortunately, we see that effect today in what we call neo-colonialism. Inshallah, we shall discuss in the coming segment.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, when we talk about the issue of excavating the buried intellects, an important role that Islam has played and definitely is playing today is to firstly force people, or rather to encourage people to think in a certain direction. So for example, if you look at the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم أَفَلَا يَنظُرُونَ إِلَى الْإِبِلِ كَيْفَ خُلِقَتْ, that why aren't the people, or why aren't the people thinking how the camels has been created? Now, if you look at the Arabs at that time, they were always looking at these camels, like they were living their lives literally with these camels, right? You can imagine, they could even, I think they would also see their dreams, like in, see this, these camels in their dreams, because literally their whole life was camels. You can see that, in the, you know, and it's a very good thing. And it's not a bad thing, it's a very good thing. But then, still, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran is telling them that, look and ponder about how they have been created. This is something very important. It shows that Islam is a religion that encourages thought, that encourages a type of thought that is very valuable, not a devalued or a useless type of thinking. Inshallah, in the coming session, we will discuss about the various dimensions which Islam has encouraged in thinking. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio. بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer the questions that you have related to Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor, you have been helping us understand what things parents can take care of when their children are facing a society wherein there are tens of people living around and you never know who is like what and who has been affected by time and society they have been living in. And sometimes there are 10 people who are good and there's just one person among them who is kind of deviated. How can you keep your child safe from that particular person you are helping the parents?
Yes, so we need to be able to talk to them, as we said before, and you should be engaged with them. And so, and you should be able to, despite all your precautions, you've taken care of everything, but despite that, there's this opportunity, there's this possibility that one may face a situation, a difficult situation. Now, you should be able to understand and realize and discern very promptly if there's something in the behavior of the child which shows that he or she is feeling stressed and there's something unusual going on which he or he cannot talk about. So that is important, very much important, that a parent can, you know, determine what that situation is.
So are you trying to say that we got to analyze the behavior? Sometimes it's unusual with the children and they are not free to share things with us.
Yes, they feel shy about it. They feel difficult. They feel that it's difficult for them to share and what's happened, unfortunately, maybe. So you need to be very, you know, aware of what's happening and very much apprehensive of anything unusual coming up just for sudden. Without being able to, you know, predict it. So we need to be very careful of and take care of any signs which may show certain sorts of depression or shyness or maybe some sort of tension or stress. And we should be prompt about and how to deal with that situation, prompt in dealing with that situation. And challenging or confronting the situation in a very calm way. The parents shouldn't lose their temper. They shouldn't lose their sanity about the issue. They may, you know, get very much if they realize that something has happened, something wrong is happening, and they want to. You want to correct the situation, they want to rectify the situation, they need to keep calm, and then they need to address the problem in a very sane and in a very wise, prudent manner.
Yeah.
So you need to, you know, also teach your children how to, as we said before, teach them what the boundaries are, what the limitations are in their behavior, especially regarding their relations with the opposite sex.
Yeah.
They should be taught, as I said, about that. So anything, if abnormal, if it happens, they can, you know, understand what has happened. He also, the child should also be able to talk about different parts of his or her body and explain to them if he has is feeling any difficulties, any problems.
All right.
I mean, it should be a normal thing.
Yeah, we'll discuss this with you after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Salman Nakavi, and we are discussing how parents can take care of things so that the children do not face sexual abuse outside. Professor, you said like if it's a time of puberty or so, and there are some changes coming into the body, we should have that distance, or we should have that modesty, as well as we should have that freeness with our children that they discuss with us those changes.
Yes, we need to talk about that in detail, and we shall do that separately. But just here, in this context, when we're talking about child abuse, sex abuse, we need to tell them, explain to them about their body parts, especially the private parts. They need to know about that in a very normal manner. And we should be able to discuss with them as a fact of life, which they have to face in any case. So it depends upon the age also. We need to discuss these issues according to the age. For example, a child who is not more than 5, we will not talk about the sex organs. We should not talk about the sex, but they still play a role in our lives. And so for urination also, or for example passing the stool also, you need to explain to them.
So
they should become normal features of our life, that you talk about them. I remember one of my teachers was saying that he remembers his childhood teacher who even in school explained to them how to carry out the ablution after passing your urination, how to carry out the washing of the, you know, private parts after you have gone to the toilet.
Yeah.
So even those things have to be explained in a very casual way, that it is a normal part of life. So if that training has taken place,
yeah.
And then as the age proceeds and progresses, and a child, a girl or a boy starts feeling those changes, then they can be explained in a very normal way, and as something which is going to happen to all of us. And they need to be aware of that, and it should not be something which they should feel shy about. You shouldn't talk to them in such a way, hush-hush way. Even sometimes, I suppose that for these normal things, we use other words which do not, for example, instead of saying urine, you say something else.
Yeah.
As some short form of it. So that gives you the impression that the actual thing is something which should not be talked about, which should not be mentioned.
Okay.
Whereas, for example,
you're saying education in this sense is important.
Yes. For example, in when we talk about, for example, the Persian language or the Urdu language, when we talk about urine in the Persian language, it is a very, very good way of saying a very, very modest and very nice-mannered way when we say pishab. Pishab means something which is before water.
Okay.
So before washing yourself, you're doing something which needs to be washed.
Needs to be washed.
So it's a metaphor. Okay. So it's become something normal. So it we shouldn't be shy of using these words as they are used in the dictionary, maybe. We don't need to go after slang words or, you know, buzzwords where we cover up the actual thing. And so people feel shy about talking about them.
Right. So Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we are discussing sexual education with Professor Salman Naqvi. Professor, you said that before this session, you said that there are some emotional controls that have to be taken care of, that have to be taught, how to manage your emotions. But today you're saying that in addition to that emotional management, the physical management is also important, how to manage your body physically when you are actually observing the changes.
Yes. So as I said, we need to talk about that in detail in another session. But now just to complete our discussion on the issue of managing child abuse and sex abuse, we need to be there for them. If there is a situation which they feel is a difficult situation, they need to feel that you will be there for them. They will be able to get in touch with you immediately upon such a situation arising. And they feel that you can be relied upon, and that you should give them the confidence that if someone is also abusing them and they are being given, for example, blackmailed, or they are being, you know, keep their mouths shut by the person who is abusing them, you should give them this feeling and understanding that nobody can harm them. If they repose their trust in their parents, the parents will take care of them, of their situation. And so once they are not, no one can blackmail them, no one can make them do things without their consent and without something which is abnormal. Therefore, you should be there for them, and we should give them this confidence that they will help them in any situation, and they will you will not become angry with them. And you will bring them out of that situation. And for being able to do that, you need to, for example, as we said before, that when we talk to them in our conversations, it shouldn't be such that they feel that we are questioning them, and we are questioning their morality or their integrity. Rather, we need to say, instead of saying, oh, what's happening nowadays, you say, is there anything you may want to discuss with me? Is there anything special on your mind? Have you something to say to me which you feel that I can help you with? So the sentences
telling them sentences that would make them feel comfortable, like, exactly. Can I help you with something?
Exactly.
So it's like even when you're talking with your children, when you're having that conversation with your children, you got to be using sentences that are very picky, that are very choosy. You have to be using sentences that show them your trust, your support, your back, and that you're there for them in each and every situation, whatever the thing they're going through. Anyways, thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. That was all time we had for today. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIP English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the role of the Iranian parliament in Iran's foreign policy with the spokesperson for the National Security and Foreign Policy Commission of the Iranian parliament, Dr. Abulfazl Amoui. But first, this brief analysis.
According to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the legislative branch, called the Islamic Shura Majlis, plays an important role in foreign policy and has to ratify any treaty or agreement that creates any obligations or expenditures for Iran. In this context, the Majlis has a supervisory role over the executive branch ministries involved in foreign affairs, particularly the Foreign Ministry, which is legally obligated to report regularly about its activities to the Majlis. Like all executive branch cabinet ministers, the Minister of Foreign Affairs has to be confirmed by the Majlis before taking office, and can be removed by the Majlis if deemed not to be performing up to standard. The Majlis also has its own mechanisms of parliamentary diplomacy, a prominent example being the many bilateral parliamentary friendship groups it maintains with other legislative bodies from around the world, as well as diplomacy related to the Islamic and Asian parliamentary unions. As the historic example of the JCPOA and the current examples of Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as well as Iran's likely future accession to the BRICS Plus shows, no international agreement is deemed legal under Iranian law until it's confirmed and ratified by the Majlis. This is in contrast to the rubber-stamp parliament that existed during the Pahlavi dynasty, which, despite some members objecting, could not even prevent the British from forcing the ruling monarch of the time to concede any claims to Bahrain during the British retreat from the Persian Gulf in 1971. Bahrain historically being Iranian territory occupied by the British when they entered the Persian Gulf in the early 19th century. Contrary to the distorted picture painted by Iran's enemies, the legislative branch, as the direct representative of a cross-section of Iranian society from all ethnic and regional backgrounds, plays an integral part in the foreign policy decision-making of Iran, and is in fact one of the greatest sources of power and credibility for the Islamic Republic in its defense of Iran's national interests and projection of power around the world, together with the executive branch, the security services, and the Supreme National Security Council. As the global order is rapidly creating new constellations and new alliances, the Islamic Shura Majlis will continue to supervise the activities of the executive branch and defend Iran's national interests, as is determined under the Constitution of the Islamic Republic, and will be a source of political power for Iran on the international scene.
Dr. Abulfazl Amoui, spokesperson for the National Security Committee of the Iranian Parliament. Thank you so much for joining us on Insight today. We've come to the Majlis here to speak with you about the role of the Parliament, of the Iranian Parliament, of the Majlis in Iranian foreign policy. As you know, and as our viewers have seen, we have done a series of programs with the different members of the foreign policy team as it relates to the foreign ministry. Today we thought it might be good to look at these issues from the perspective of the parliament. So we would like to ask you to please give us some insight first into the role of the Iranian parliament, of the Islamic consultative assembly, in the larger context of Iranian foreign policy, where it becomes involved, those places that are particularly important to the Majlis. And then later we can discuss some of the other subjects specifically that you are working now on in the Majlis. So if you could please, with your permission, if we could start our conversation with you giving us a little bit of an insight, a little bit of an explanation for our viewers who are the global audience who might not be familiar about the role of the Majlis in Iranian foreign policy.
منم از شما ممنونم بابت این فرصتی که فراهم شد از شما آقای ترابیان.
Thank you for this opportunity, and thank you, Mr. Tarabi, for this interview. The Parliament is the legislative body of our country, and it pursues two main duties. One is legislation, specifically in foreign policy. The approval of our country's international obligations takes place in the Majlis, or Parliament. The second duty of the Parliament in Iran is supervising the performance of executive bodies, part of which is defined in foreign policy. Therefore, the Parliament has the opportunity to invite the foreign minister and officials involved in foreign affairs on various occasions. At a higher level, the representatives can raise a query to any minister, or if they recognize that an issue requires a more serious reaction, it may even reach the stage of impeachment from the replies and explanations of the ministers, as well as confirming or rejecting it by the representatives. For this reason, the Parliament is generally involved in all the country's issues. It has the power to receive answers and raise questions with the country's executive branch. This is also manifested in foreign policy. In addition, parliamentarians, as representatives of the people of our nation, also perform two other duties. One is the stances they take, part of which is the collective stance which takes place in the form of statements. It is customary that the Iranian parliament and the representatives give their opinion on a joint issue, particularly foreign affairs, by signing a statement. The statement is more of a position declaration. It is non-binding, but it is an act that happens in foreign policy. Another part of the Majlis's duty in foreign policy is pursuing the issue of parliamentary diplomacy. You are well aware that parliaments, along with governments, have started their foreign relations for years. A complementary aspect of formal diplomacy is pursued in parliamentary diplomacy. This is also customary in our parliament. We follow it in our bilateral relations with other countries' parliaments, and I can specifically say that we have a parliamentary friendship group with more than 70 parliaments in the world. That is, the countries that have declared their readiness, a number of representatives who are interested in strengthening relations with that country, become members of the friendship group. A friendship group will be created in that other country as well. These two friendship groups establish relations and support issues that are of common interest to the two countries, and the people's representatives are interested in them. They try to push their governments towards enhancing cooperation with the influence they have on executive organizations, or if there are controversial issues, they can move forward these relations, which are popular rather than formal. That is, these representatives pursue what they think is in the interest of their people through mutual relations in friendship groups. There is another aspect in parliamentary diplomacy. That is the issue of attending international parliamentary assemblies, the most important of which is the International Parliamentary Union, IPU, which dates back to more than 120 years and is among the oldest international institutions. The Islamic Republic of Iran and Iran's Majlis is part of this organization. An assembly is held biannually. A delegation of 15 Iranian MPs from a committee that examines the IPU's meetings and related individuals participate in this committee and express the positions of Iran's Majlis. International parliamentary assemblies are not just IPU. We have the Parliamentary Union of Islamic Countries, PUIC, where Iran's Majlis plays an effective role. We are a parliament that hosts the secretariat of this organization in Tehran. Another assembly that exists between the parliaments is APA, Association of the Asian Parliaments. This union was established by the initiative of Iran between the Asian countries' parliaments, and its secretariat is also in Tehran. There are other assemblies that we are present in as Iran's Majlis. We participate in decision makings and declare our position and play a role in parliamentary diplomacy. As a result, Iran's Majlis plays a role in foreign policy alongside the government, alongside departments such as the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Supreme National Security Council. But beyond that, it also plays a role in determining foreign policy macro strategies, which is mostly about supervising the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and approving international laws and treaties, which must take place in Iran's Majlis according to the Constitution.
So it's interesting. You're saying that in Iran, given the system, the political system that exists, whatever decisions are being made, whatever treaties are being signed, whatever agreements, formal agreements that are being made, they all have to be ratified by the parliament, and this is something that is required by the constitution. Is this, have I understood you correct?
Yes. According to Article 129 and 135 of the Constitution, any treaty that the Islamic Republic of Iran joins, which the negotiation process and its accession is generally carried out by the government and sometimes specifically by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, must be approved by Iran's Majlis as well. Therefore, all the treaties that are binding, that is, create an obligation for our country to take an action or pay a financial cost or provide a space for another country, all of these must have the approval of the representatives of the Iranian people. Without the approval of the Iranian nation's representatives, these treaties cannot be implemented. And for this reason, Iran's Majlis has a decisive role in accepting or rejecting international commitments.
Okay, so let's look at some examples, because this is very interesting that you're mentioning this. Some people might not realize that this is the way it works in Iran, that it's a full-fledged system where you have these checks and balances between the different branches of government. And as you said, it's a complementary role that the Majlis plays with the executive branch. We have, of course, the example of the nuclear talks about the JCPOA, and also this is more of a historic example. Also, recently we have Iran's accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and in the future it looks like we'll be joining the BRICS organization as well. So, if you could talk about these three examples that we talked about: the nuclear talks, the JCPOA, the ongoing nuclear talks. That we saw that, for example, the foreign minister talked about the time for these talks is not unlimited. There might come a time when the Majlis will decide that it's no longer needed for Iran to have those discussions with the U.S. But also the recent accession to the Shanghai Organization, as you said, it creates certain responsibilities for Iran if they wants to join it, and also in the future for BRICS. So if you could please give us some insight in these three examples.
I will start with the topic of Shanghai, so I can point out an example of Majlis's role. Well, our government has adopted a new approach in which it has put strengthening relations with Asia and Eurasia countries on the agenda. This approach is also supported by the parliament. That is, the Majlis's general view is close to that of the government in this sense. In practice, this opportunity was provided for the Islamic Republic in the past year that after applying for membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, our Ministry of Foreign Affairs negotiated with the secretariat of this organization and reached a document based on which Iran became a member of this organization. Well, joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization requires that the 45 documents which have been approved so far in this organization start their approval process in the new member country. In the same framework, we received a bill from the government a few months ago, which, after reviewing them, the government proposed to the parliament to inspect these 45 documents and to ratify them if it finds them in Iran's national interests. Well, this matter was referred to the National Security and Foreign Policy Committee of the Iranian parliament. We reviewed these documents.